The bandwidth for this episode of the Precision Rifle Podcast is sponsored by the Firearms Radio Network. FirearmsRadio.tv.
Precision Rifle Podcast, episode number 95. This week, we've got Derek Peterson with us of the Peterson Cartridge Company, which is a newer company that's starting up. Maybe you saw us on the Facebook page. We shared it. I'm holding this show hostage until he agrees to start making 6.5 Creedmoor brass. But no, I'm just kidding. But no, he's got some pretty neat stuff going on here, and I wanted to hear from Derek himself about what they got going on. So with that, I'll let Derek introduce himself a little bit, and then we'll get into the rest of the show.
Hi, Kirk. It's good to be on the show. I'm glad to be here. I'm Derek Peterson from Peterson Cartridge. I'm the president of Peterson Cartridge. We're a Pittsburgh-based shell casing manufacturer, brass shell casing manufacturer. We specialize in long distance, long range, high precision brass rifle casings. That's what we do.
Cool. So how did you get in? How did you decide you wanted to make rifle brass?
I have two other partners, and business partners, and they were saying, we want to get into the gun and ammunition industry. We're longtime shooters, longtime hunters, and they said, find a way in. And so we started going to some of the shows, you know, NASGW, SHOT Show, some of the other shows, and I found out that there was a big shortage of precision, high quality, U.S. made, long distance rifle caliber brass. And so that's how we decided there was, you know, found the shortage and said we wanted to get into it. So
cool. So now you guys are, you're based out of, I'm sorry, where'd you say you're based out of?
Yeah, no, we're based out of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
Out of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
Just north.
Okay.
Yeah.
But you're in...
I'm in Utah right now. I've been living in Utah for the past, since probably 8 months. And I've been living at the machinery manufacturer. We bought new manufacturing equipment, not the old 1940s stuff. And it's the first of it in the world, surprisingly enough, of this kind of machinery. And when you're buying the first of anything in the world, no one knows how to use it, including anyone you could hire. And so you have to learn how to use it. And the only real way to do that is to go live with the people who build it. So I've been out here for about 8 months, living at the facility and learning the ins and outs of the new machinery, the new tech stuff.
Cool. So I guess let's hear about the manufacturing process a little bit before we get into some of the other questions. So my understanding is you guys get some big rolls of brass in, and it goes through some machines, and out comes brass on the other side. Can you break that down a little bit for us?
Yeah, that's pretty close. We start with our raw material is cups. And so let's take it back before the cup. So let's take it back to the we'll take it back to the brass rolling mill. So the mills get in scrap. Most mills take in scrap. And then they melt the scrap down, and then they do what's called alloying up. And so they alloy up using raw ingot. So, brass, copper, zinc, and trace elements. And so they take their scrap in, they melt it, then they take a sample, figure out where their composition is, and like a spark spectrometer test, and then they alloy up to get to the C260, which is what we use. So that's cartridge brass. So the technical term is C260. That's the name of it. And then they pour it into these giant bars, and then they roll it into these coils, which are, thin strip that get rolled into these coils. The coils then go off and they get slit, where they basically get cut long ways. Instead of being 4 feet wide, they make four of them that are 1 feet wide. or one foot wide, and then they run it through the cupping process. The cupping process is a pretty cool thing to see. They feed quail in, and it's a giant chunk, and cups come out the other end. So we get the cups delivered to us in big wire-bound crates. So we take the cups out of the wire-bound crates, and we do our initial testing. And so we have a bunch of different testing. So we do metallurgical composition to make sure that the brass is the correct composition. We want to make sure that it's, it's 70-30 brass is what it's called. It's cartridge brass. So 70% copper, 30% zinc minimum. And so we make sure our ratios are right. Then we go in and do some micro hardness testing to make sure that the brass is the correct temper. We also do some grain structure analysis to make sure that the grains are the correct size. So after we go and do all of our testing that we have to do on the inbound cups to make sure that they're going to perform in our process well, we go into our first station, which is cleaning. So we clean the inbound cups to make sure they're completely free of contaminants. They go into our first draw, and so that's basically a big drawing press that it's basically a stem and a die, and it draws and it elongates the cup into a tube. So now I'm gonna go from the word cup to the word tube. So we have tubes now. They come out, they go through our annealing oven to soften them back up. A lot of people know this. I'm sure most of your listeners know it, but brass work hardens. So every time you work it, you scrape it, you do anything to it, it gets harder. So you have to soften it back up in the annealing furnaces. And so then you go in through a wash. So our washes are specialized. They're green washes, so they can go down the drain, which is good environmentally good for us. We don't have to dispose of really hazardous chemicals. After they get cleaned, they go into our second draw. They get elongated again. It's the same annealing process after, and the same wash process after. And they go into third draw. So after third draw, they go from, they get elongated, and at the same time, they get the top of them trimmed off. So now we have two pieces. So we have the trim ring, which is a small little brass ring, and we have the actual tube, the finished length tube. And all of this you can see on our website. We have all the process listed out at www.petersoncartridge.com. And so we have all of the processes listed out in pictures, so you guys can see exactly how we do what we do. So like I was saying, after the third draw, it goes into a wash. Again, same kind of wash, different chemicals. And then it goes into the heading press. So we do a pocket and a head. Some calibers, bigger calibers, like a 50 caliber, those are just headed. And so what that does is, we'll start with the pocketing process. So the pocketing process basically puts a small dimple in the bottom of the casing. And all that does is makes the head harder. And so, like I said earlier, brass work hardens. And so if you move it mechanically, it's going to get harder. And a lot, almost all shooters value a hard head on the casing for reloadability and for, having no gas leak on the primer pocket. So we pocket, and then we go into heading where we put our name. So we go in, we finish making the primer pocket in the heading operation. We also put our name on there. Making brass, custom brass for someone, we put their name on there. And then we go into our head turn operations. This is where we cut the extractor. It's basically like a lathe operation for the most part, except the part goes into a chuck and gets held and spun. And then we put a cutter in and basically touch off of it, and it cuts the extractor. It trims off a little bit of the excess flash or spill area on the bottom of the casing that happens in the heading process. So after the heading process, the casing, the base of the head of it is as hard as it's ever going to get prior to firing. And so you can't make it any harder. If your casing isn't to the hardest that you want at that point, there's nothing you can do. You have to scrap it. So that's assuming that, we do all of our testing. So we would do all of our testing, our micro hardness testing, to make sure that, we section the casings in half, make sure that they're the right hardness at all the different points.
in the head of the casing, so primer pocket side walls and extractor proof areas. So there's a whole list of places that we check. And then they go in, so after they've gone through the head turn, they go into our taper machine. So we call it annealing taper. So we do an inductive annealing instead of a flame anneal. Inductive annealing is, so I prefer inductive because it is less forgiving. It doesn't tolerate any folds, any splits, any crimps, anything in the brass that's an impurity or an imperfection. If there is something like that, it literally blows the casing apart. It's left with giant gaping holes. And so it won't run through the machinery. It gets caught by one of our DTEC stations that then drops it out and it goes into scrap. So it goes and gets, so it gets heated up in the annealing, in the same machine, in the annealing taper. It gets heated up so that it's formable, and then it gets tapered down. Now our taper is in a three draw or a three taper setup. So our first one starts the lead in to the taper of the tube, and then the second one does a lot of work. It does most of the taper. And then the third taper is basically a plugging die. So it's going to resize the mouth of the casing. It's going to iron out any ripples, imperfections, anything like that in the casing. After that, it's covered in lubricant, you know, from the tapering operation. It goes into another wash, which is, again, the same green solution, different solution, of course, but it's still green. And then we go into our pierce and trim machine. And so at this point, the casings are super long. And they have no flash hole. So they go into our pierce and trim machine. So pierce and trim, we load them in. They go down through. They get the flash hole pierced first, which is kind of a fun operation. A little trickier than most people realize, because you have to support the metal on the inside of the casing. So there's a backing die and a stem associated with it. And of course, your vent punch tool. So they get their vent hole punch, or the flash hole punch, however you want to call it. And then they go and get their final trim done. So now they're trimmed to length. After they leave that machine, they go into the second to last machine, which is the mouth and neck anneal. So at this station, we do use inductive annealing again, and we put the casings through the feeder bowl, and they go down inside, and they have their a certain percentage of the body annealed again. And it's on a gradient, so it's a hardness gradient. And this is what controls even bullet release, reloadability. And the hardness gradient along the casing side. So that's what that machine does. They come out of there, and we went a step further recently and decided we want all of our casings to be chamfered on the mount and chamfered on the flash hole. And so we built a machine to do that. It was kind of my brainchild. Some of it, you know, some of our machinery manufacturers helped with it as well. But it chamfers the flash hole, an inside chamfer on the flash hole, to make sure there's even flash distribution from when the primer goes off. And it ignites the powder even. And then, like I said, it chamfers the casing mount to make sure that when you put your bullets and you see your bullets in the casings, it doesn't shave the bullet, you know, the mouth of the casing doesn't shave the bullet jacket off, which, you know, is going to cause all kinds of problems. So sorry for being long-winded. That, in essence, is basically the process.
Sure. Cool. So these machines you're talking about, now these are pretty custom machines, correct?
They are.
You don't just call up company A and order a press.
No.
That may...
So we're talking millions and millions of dollars worth of machines. And they're very customized. They only do one thing, it's making ammunition. They are interchangeable so that we can change calibers over. So if we decide one day we want to make 308, the next day we want to make 6.5 Creedmoor, the next day we want to make 300 Win Mag, it has the ability to change over to make the new calibers.
Sure. Hey, and speaking of 6.5 Creedmoor, I've been joking with Derek about that since we started the call. I was joking with Tom, who got a hold of me and asked me if I wanted to have him on the show. about him making 6.5 Creedmoor. Any listeners out there that want 6.5 Creedmoor, I'm going to make Derek give you an email address that he can reach you at. Email him and let him know that you want 6.5 Creedmoor. You got an email?
Yeah, oh, absolutely. It's D. Peterson, like the company name Peterson, at petersonbrewage.com.
Uh-oh, you're going to have to repeat that. It broke up.
No problem. So D. Peterson at petersoncartridge.com.
All right. And then, or the Facebook page. Blow up their Facebook page with it, too.
Yeah, if there's enough demand, let them know you want it. We're seriously thinking about doing the 6.5. We know that the demand's out there. I'm excited for it. I really hope that it's something we can do.
Right on. Well, so right now you're fairly limited in what you're selling. You're a pretty new company. You're a quality based company. So I mean, it's understandable that you don't have a lot of stuff right now. But basically, you're running 308, 300, and you're working on 338 Lapua, right?
Yeah, 308, 300 Win Mag, and 338 Lapua. Yeah, right now that's where we're focusing. We have a lot of plans to move into a lot of different calibers. As you can imagine, you know, being a newer company, it's kind of hair on fire right now with trying to get all your ducks lined in a row, but we'll get there to the point where we can start making some more offerings. But we want to make sure that what we offer really, really, really good stuff. We can't let quality slip to put out another product.
Now, how do you make the belt on a belted cartridge like the 300? Because I mean, do you have to turn the whole casing then, or
no? So, the way the belts are made, it's kind of a fun.
Real quick here, for anybody listening, if you're not familiar with a belted cartridge, any of the cartridges based off the 375 H&H, like your 300 Win Mag or your 7mm Rem Mag or that kind of stuff, it's got a ring around the base. Yeah, a ring around the base of the cartridge.
So the ring was developed by the H&H. I think it's Holland. They developed the band, and it was originally for head spacing. However, as I understand it, this is one person's opinion, it is kind of a big feature. You know, they did it on Magnum calibers to make sure that the casing was head spaced correctly. However, for some reason, you don't need it on a 50 caliber. So like a 50 BMG or like a 338 Lapua, you don't need that. And so what happened was when people realized they didn't need it, they had so many guns chambered in it that they had to keep making the band. They had to keep that alive. And so your question about how it's made, it's tricky. It's not easy. It's usually a two-step process. A lot of manufacturers make it differently. Ours is a two-step process. So we, in the heading operation, we try to constrain it in such a way, another part, that we form part of the band in the heading operation, and we form part of the band in the taper operation. So it's kind of a joint effort by two different machines to make that band.
Okay, and then does it get like finished off with the trimmer when you cut the extractor ring, or is it kind of just?
So the belt is the same. Last time I believe the belt is the same diameter as the extractor. Rim, and so you're basically just cutting the groove, and you're leaving the belt and the extractor rim, you know, about the, you know, the same thickness.
Sure. Yeah, that does sound like a pain.
Yeah, it's tricky.
So, how'd you pick those three cartridges? 308, I guess, is understandable. I guess those 300. I guess they're all pretty understandable because they're pretty popular calibers.
Yeah, it's a reasonable question. I mean, how do you pick what you're going to do? How do you commit? It came down to, we did a study on price per piece and volume. I mean, it was a business decision for us. It was how many can we sell and what's the price? So if we decided to make 223, we could make all that we could sell. But you can't sell them for very much because you're competing with the government to make those. So we stuff the government didn't choose to make. You know, we're not going to make 50 BMG. We're not going to make, you know, they do make the 308, the 7.62, but they don't really make a long distance precision one, and right. they make the 223. So yeah, that's basically how we pick.
Yeah. Well, they make the match stuff, don't they? They make the Lake City, the like the LR-118s and stuff. That's a match press, ain't it?
They do. I haven't studied that one very much. I should have been more prepared for that question. I haven't studied I know people that know about it, but I personally don't.
Okay. Sure. I don't really know much about it either. Aside from that, it's a thing. So, now, one thing that I thought was interesting is that you have a full metallurgy lab, basically, specifically for making sure that all this stuff is consistent and the same and high quality. Can you go into a little bit of detail with that?
Of course, yeah. So, one of the first things we did, probably the first thing we did, was start assembling our lab. We knew that if we knew that long-distance shooters is who we wanted to cater to. And we know that they're not dumb. They know what good is, and they know how to measure what good is. And so if we were going to sell and actually legitimately cater to long-distance shooters, we had to build a lab, an impressive lab, a lab that was fitting, and it was fitting for what we were trying to do, which was make long-distance cases. So we, over about a year and a half, we did all the learning necessary to figure out, okay, so what kind of tools do we need? What kind of points are we going to measure on the casings? What kind of tools are we going to need? And we are able, so as of now, we're able to do grain structure analysis of the casings and of the cups on the inbound and outbound, you know, for the casings. We're able to do micro hardness testing. To test the casings in all the different areas. And we also have a complete ballistics lab. So we can do internal pressures, velocities, of course, and we can do proof loads and make sure that the casings, if they are overloaded or something, you know, bad happens, we can comply with SAMI spec to make sure that we're not going to put anybody in danger. You know, safety being huge in this.
Right. Right. Well, cool. Because I know you were talking. Before the show, me and Derek talked for quite a while about stuff that we should have held off on and made part of the show. But
you were asking about the final forming process.
Yeah.
So that's all in the taper dies, you know, that's a big one. You run out concentricity, you know, things that folks care about, the long distance shooters care about, sidewall variation. It's been our goal to have the best. So one of the things we were talking about earlier was we don't want to ever be rightfully accused of being cheap and it harming our outcomes. So we bought the best equipment, the most technologically advanced equipment the world has to offer, currently. We spent long on the lab, you know, to try to make sure that we can measure. If you can measure it, you can manage it. And so we want to be able to manage all of our casings' attributes or the features. And so another piece of it was we want to make sure that we're putting the best raw material in. And to that end, I traveled around the country and around the world to go and see cup manufacturers. So what makes a good cup? You know, the old saying, you know, bad in, bad out, crap in, crap out. That's true. I mean, it's true as the day is long. And so I went around the country, the world, to find the best cups. And I found what I believe are the best cups. Some of them are from the United States. Some of them are from Europe. Our goal was to make an American-made product, you know, by American workers on American machines, not, you know, French machines or anything else, American machines, but using the best raw materials available in the world. and the cup is a huge, you know, it's getting the best cup. That's a huge part of making a good case.
Sure. And that makes sense. You know, it's all about quality components, and you know, if you skimp on something halfway through, you know, it's going to show up at the end.
Yeah. So I don't think I answered your question, though, about the final forming. That's the third taper time. Yeah, we plugging and to make sure that they're all the same size, the mouths are all concentric. But sorry, I just didn't want to leave that hanging.
No, that's fine. Before, you were talking about your flash holes. Those are punched in the back, right?
Yeah, we debated doing drilled or punched. We did a casing study to see what the industry actually does. You know, some people say that, you know, these guys do a drilled flash hole and it's better, and there's no burrs or something like that. And we did, like I said, our casing study to see what everyone did. We found one company that looks like they drill. And so we do punch. We found the punch is very accurate. And we also do, like I was saying, on our last station, we do that flash hole chamfer. And so, you know, we keep our punches sharp, and so we don't create burrs. And just that, we chamfer, you know, because even if you don't make a burr, it's still one tiny hole. Whereas if you chamfer, it's an even flash distribution into the powder so that it ignites evenly and burns evenly.
Right on. So what kind of how consistent are your cases as far as weight goes? And
yeah, so we don't hand sort for weight, and it's not because we don't want to, it's because we at this time we don't need to. Use consistent enough cups, and our machines are capable of distributing and moving that grass where it's supposed to get moved during the draw processes, that we can produce casings within about a grain, half a grain, usually. Sometimes there's a flyer that's 2.5 grains, but that's about as high as we've ever seen. It's about 2.5 grains.
Oh, wow. That's good.
Yeah, it's good. Yeah, it is very good. You know, when we – what changes that – is, and it goes back to the raw material. If your cup is, say, 5 grains higher than the next cup, that as a percentage is going to get transferred into the casing. And so your casing is going to become a little bit heavier, a little bit lighter. It also, you know, weight is also controlled by your extraction tool, how deep it gets cut, its location, its position. So there's a lot of different factors. How short the casing is, what your overall length affects the weight. We found that our casings, you know, which is, folks talk about the weight of the casing because it's believed to be the easiest way to measure consistency in brass.
Right.
But there's way more factors that affect weight than just the vessel on the inside of the casing is bigger or smaller. You know, that's what people are really after, right? They're, you know, like a casing, it's a pressure vessel. It's a pressure vessel with, it's a sealed pressure vessel. Got one hole on, a big hole on the one end, a little hole on the other one that fire goes into, and it has a bolt, you know, a high energy material on the inside, you know, smokeless powder. And so it creates pressure. And so if the casing, the volume of that cylinder, which is the casing, the inside of the casing, is smaller or larger, depending on the amount of powder you put in, you're going to get a different velocity. And so I guess what I was getting on is we're very consistent as far as weight. Not that, you know, your followers, they're going to sort for a tenth of a grain or 5/10 of a grain. Or 5/10 of a grain, where that's consistent for them. Consistent for us is being able to produce within a grain to a grain and a half per, you know, of swing variance per casing. And usually if they come off right in the same lot, they'll be really, really close. I'm talking extremes where we go from one different shipment of cups in to a completely different shipment of cups. If they're in the same lot, then they're going to be really close.
Okay. Well, that's cool. Because, I mean, how much... Have you done any volume testing?
Yeah.
Now, what are you seeing with volume testing versus the weights of the cartridges?
We've seen that... So military caliber, so military cartridges, so like Lake City, they're a thicker wall, and so they tend to be a little bit heavier. Whereas, if I remember right, I don't know if you tested Lake City. They had a smaller internal volume because they have the thicker walls. A good measurement of weight. Our good correlation is webbing thickness. The thickness of the webbing between the primer block and the inside of the vessel, inside of the chamber of the casing. The thicker the web, usually the higher the weight. There's kind of a ratio that we go by, but it's pretty predictable. If your webbing is a little bit thicker or a little bit skinnier, you're going to have a variance in weight, which wouldn't necessarily affect the internal volume of the casing either, having a little thicker flash or a little thicker webbing. Yes. You know, the inside diameter, you know, the inside vessel, that's all controlled by stem. And so the stem is going to punch in the exact same distance. The sidewalls are going to perform exactly the same in the taper dies. So I mean, I didn't mean to belabor the point or go in too long about it, but internal volume is very important. We do measure it. We have measured our competition. So,
right on. Oh man, you know, it's funny. We talked about so much stuff before, and so you're in. Oh, I'm sorry, I forget.
No, you're good.
Idaho or Utah?
Utah.
I keep wanting to say Idaho. I keep wanting to say Idaho, but then I think to myself, that's not right.
Idaho is right above it. You're close.
Yeah.
Ballpark, right?
It's all west anyway.
It's all west.
So you're over there basically learning how to run the machines. Are you going to be loading those machines up and heading back to Pennsylvania, or is the production facility going to stay there and the headquarters be run out of Pennsylvania?
No, we have a factory back in Pennsylvania. We've started hiring workers. It's kind of fun. We get to have our sister company who does manufacturing of capacitors and everything else. That, you know, they make stuff like really high tech stuff that goes in air-to-air missiles, fighter jet ejector seats, things like that. And so they're helping us with our hiring to make sure we hire the best. We want to make sure that we get great operators who are paying really well, which is I'm super proud of. You know, I don't want to be in a business that depends, you know, its bottom line depends on paying someone so they're, you know, a small enough dollar amount that they're not able to live. I want people to have a car they can respect. I want people to have a house they can like live in. I want their kids to be able to afford, you know, new clothes for school. It's just all the little stuff. So we're paying really long. So we have a factory set up back in Pennsylvania. Within the next few months, we're not exactly sure what date yet, we're going to take these machines, we're going to load them up on pallets, and we're going to put them on the truck. And we're going to ship them back to Pennsylvania, and I'm going to escort that truck, making sure nothing happens on the way back to Pennsylvania. I don't know if I'm going to have to close intersections down or what, but we'll figure something out.
Right on. Have a regular convoy rolling through.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking.
Man, can you hear me? Did I lose you?
No, I'm still here.
Oh, good. Yeah, no, it just got quiet for a minute there. I thought maybe I lost you. Well, that's interesting. How long do you think the shutdown will be for that?
I'm thinking 2 weeks.
Oh, that's not bad.
Yeah, you know, and that's taken into account. It's going to be probably 3 or 4 days worth of travel, and then we have to get everything set up and re-zeroed back in Pennsylvania. To make sure that nothing shifted during travel, you know, bumps and all. So.
You do start out with a roll of brass, right? And you make the cups?
No, we don't make the cups. We start off with the cups.
Okay.
And so the brass is rolled in the mill, and then usually, like with some of the big, all the big cup manufacturers, they have a mill on site, which is set up for either strip or rod, and then they go into the, once they get done rolling, they go into the cupping operation, which is on site, but separate. So we receive everything in these big crates. They're wood-sided crates, wire-bound crates.
Okay.
Make a good table if you flip them over.
don't put that on Pinterest. you're gonna be shipping me a bunch of those.
Yeah, I'm gonna be shipping great desks.
Well, right on. How long have you been doing this?
This whole thing started in 2013. It was the fall of 2013. I was working at one of our sister companies, and we decided, you know, like I was saying before, we want to get into ammunition. I wasn't really liking what I was doing, and I, like I said, I love hunting, I love shooting. I'm a member of the NRA. Shooting's in my blood, and so is hunting. And so, you know, my business partner said, hey, let's figure this out. It started in the fall of 2013, and then it was going to shows. I remember we went to the first show, which was the NASGW show, the wholesale show, when it was in Texas. I think it was Dallas, Texas. And we got to go to that show and saw the, it was right before the anniversary of JFK assassination, I think. Because we went to the observatory and saw all that. But that's a whole different side story. I'm sorry, I mean to get into it. Yeah. So that was the fall of 2013 was about when we decided we want to do this. And then it was in the spring of 2014 that we did the old spit in the hand and shake on it kind of thing between all three of us partners. We said, so we're going to do this. You know, sat back, thought about all the options and said, let's pull the trigger. Let's make this
cool.
Happen.
Cool. So how long have you been producing brass?
We've been making brass since, I'm going to say, April of this year. Yeah. April of this year.
Okay.
So relatively new. I mean, very, very new.
Yeah.
We've been sending out bunch of samples. You know, we have two basic customer channels. We have the sales to OEMs, so, you know, loading houses that load up ammunition for people to shoot, and they're on the store shelves, so those guys are on store shelves. And then we have the option of people who want to buy through us, you know, buy casings, your listeners. You know, folks that care about the reloading components. They sit in their basements on Friday nights and Saturday nights, and they weigh out powder, and they weigh their components to get them all like weights, and they weigh their casings, and they measure their primers, and, you know, guys who care about the details. So those are the two channels. You know, it's folks, OEMs, who produce a really, really high-end product. Silencer market is pretty big. You know, our casings are great for silence because the internal volumes of our casings vary so little that you can be right on that cusp of, you know, subsonic or supersonic, and you can hold subsonic, which is, you know, nice because you can't always do that.
Yeah,
you know, if we get a casing with a wide volume swing, one round you're subsonic, the next round you're supersonic.
Right. Yeah, where you get that you know, couples
loud.
Yeah. You get a couple real quiet ones, and you get that one that cracks.
Really loud one. Yeah, and so our casings are great for that. We have some customers that are trying to incorporate them into the subsonic market. And, you know, I'm excited for all of those different channels. But, you know, probably most excited, you know, our mission statement our company motto, when it comes down to it, is we have one main goal. It's to produce extremely consistent, American-made rifle casings designed around and for long-distance marksmen. And so that's our core. If, we want to help service the OEMs too, but our core is the guys who care, the guys and gals who care about precision, the ones who are going to load their own rounds, the ones who are going to roll their own, roll their own, for lack of a better term. That's our core. And so we want to stay faithful to them. And that's why we've set up channels for people to order online. Our website is petersoncartridge.com. We have an ordering section there. If you have any questions, any of your listeners have any questions, we're happy to take calls anytime. Like I said, my email address is dpeterson@petersoncartridge.com. You can contact me anytime. It might take me a day to get back to you because I'm up to my elbows in a machine or something. I have to figure out what's going on with it because we can't start it up. But I'll get back to you. Someone's going to get back to you. And, if you want to order casings, we're happy to get them shipped out real quick to you. And we're big on feedback, too. That's kind of a fun thing about us, is we're small enough and new enough that we're really open to advice, criticism, opinions, and your findings. And I hope that never changes with us, even when we get big and we start producing 100 million casings a year instead of our current capacity, which is about 6 million. I'm going to try, do everything I can to stay humble like that and take the advice from the shooters, the guys and gals on the ground who are finding out all the nitty-gritty stuff about the casings and are actually doing the shooting. Because we do a lot of shooting, to test, but nothing like the shooting that our customers do.
All right, on. If you don't mind me asking, I don't know if it's information you can give out or not, but who's currently loading with your brass? If you don't want to bring it up, I can understand.
I can't. I wish I could. I want to. I hope you'll understand, but
yeah,
I can't.
No, that's fine.
You'll... hopefully, as time goes on, we're able to be a little more candid about who's loading with us and who's not loading with us.
Is it your head stamp?
We do some our head stamp, so that'll be pretty easy to find. Some of it's not, though. A lot of it's not. Some people want to build their brand, and we respect that. We absolutely respect that.
Yeah.
You have to. It's the business that we're in.
Yep.
But at the same time, if we ever get to a point where some of our customers are like, yeah, we'd love to have you tell everybody in the world that we're loading your stuff, you'll be the first to know.
Sounds good.
I'll let you know.
Yeah, and actually, it's kind of like we were talking about earlier. There's quite a few brass companies that aren't actually making the brass,
Oh, tons of them.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. A lot of people give off the perception that they're making the brass. And, truth be told, there's only I don't want to underestimate. Maybe it's less than 10, brass manufacturers in the United States. it's less than that. But I'm going to be cautious and say less than 10. Because there could be a new one that started up yesterday, and I don't want to be a liar,
Right, yeah.
So, yeah, but most people don't make the brass. Brass is really tricky. I was telling you earlier on the call, when we first got into this, someone actually said the words alchemy. Brass is like alchemy. It's magic, kind of. It performs in ways you didn't think it could. It does things that you never thought it could withstand. It'll have an elongation percentage that's through the roof, and then, the next one it tears in half. And so it's not alchemy. It's not black magic. It's science. It's grain structure. It's micro hardness. It's composition. If it's the exact same material, so composition, and it's tempered the exact same way, grain structure, it it's going to perform just about the exact same way if you do the exact same process to it. My opinion, one guy's opinion, but my opinion nonetheless, I guess.
Yeah. And it sounds like you got everything together, you know, as far as to make good brass, you know.
It's been fun. We've had to get help along the way.
Yeah, it's like I was telling you earlier. I was at work today thinking to myself, man, I hope, you know, because I talked to your marketing manager, you know, I didn't actually talk to you, and I'm at work today. I'm like, yeah. Man, I hope this guy knows what he's talking about.
Yeah, I hope he's not going to make a fool of himself. Yeah, and I appreciate you taking the time and the trust to come on your show. I know that it's not easy to do. You take a risk anytime you invite someone on that it could be bad. I hope that I do a good enough job.
Oh, yeah. No, it's fine. It was just I just for some reason I was thinking that earlier, and I know I told you that earlier.
But, yeah.
That's funny. So we talked about SHOT Show a little earlier. Did you have a booth at SHOT Show this last year?
Yeah, we did. And we're going to have one at 2016. I don't know, don't hold me to this, but it looks like we're going to be at the NRA show as well.
Okay. Where's that going to be this year?
Ooh, see, that's in the marketing department. That's Tom. I don't know. They tried to get me involved in that, but
he tells you where to be and when.
I tell you, SHOT Show is going to be in Vegas. I'm sure of that.
Yeah.
So, we're going to have a booth at SHOT Show. We're in the basement, you know, with all the other, you know, companies in that area. So we're in the basement, and anybody who wants to stop by, we're always happy to have visitors. We, you know, if we have any new products coming out, we'll be displaying them at SHOT Show.
You're 6'5 Creedmoor?
Yeah, that, yeah, that in particular. There's a couple big things coming up that'll be fun, is what it looks like. I can't tell you any more than that. Some things that some of your listeners are going to be pretty excited about. But I really want to tell you, but I can't. So I'm excited. So please, as soon as I'm allowed to tell you, I will tell you. There's some fun stuff coming out that'll probably be displayed at SHOT Show. So
we'll have to have you back on at that point in time to kind of come on and talk about the new stuff that you do have going on.
Yes. Yeah, that'd be a blast. I would love that. Yeah, I would love that. That'd be fantastic.
Oh. So how much inventory do you have for 308 if people want to order a bunch? I mean, you got plenty on hand, I'm guessing.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, plenty. So we are selling it as we're doing 100% inspection. We're still refining some of our process. We want to make sure that, you know, nothing, you know, is out of spec. So we're doing 100% inspection.
Is what you're saying right now is if I ordered, you can order, is it 50 pieces for
25, 50, 100, 200, 500, 1,000, whatever you want to order, we can take it.
All right. So just right now, is there any break for high volume?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, our high volume the OEMs is, you know, what we really call high volume. So if you want to order more than 10,000 pieces, we can put your head stamp on it. Pretty cool. If it's good for hunting clubs and, you know, shooting clubs that wanted to get their head stamp on some brass, we can make that happen for them. I think that's kind of fun.
That's cool. I never thought of that. What would 1,000 1,000 pieces? Let's
1,000. That's the still. You're still under that 10,000.
Oh right, mark. But I mean, if you had 10 guys and each guy wanted 1,000, I'm just
10 guys.
I'm
want
trying
1,000
to break it down.
Pieces. Oh yeah, you could do 10,000 pieces, and we could do an order, get it shipped out for you. It'd be 10 boxes of 1,000. We have that stock now, so that's. If you wanted your own head stamp, it'd take us a little bit. It'd take us a couple weeks. It'd take us probably, I'm going to say we probably haven't produced in a month and a half. It takes a couple weeks to get a bunner in, and then we get it run. We might have some orders in front of you, but we get it filled as fast as we could.
Oh, that would be kind of neat. Do you do any breaks for, like, under that kind of a limit? Like, let's say somebody calls up wants sort of 1,000. Is there any kind of break for that right now or not really?
We'd have to look at it and talk about it a little more, but our main breaks are for the OEM. So we're talking, over 50,000, over 100,000, and then over 500,000, and then over a million. Okay. And if anybody wants to order a million, please contact me. we'd be more than happy to take care of you. Even if you want to order one, you know, a 21 pack of 25, we are always happy to talk to you. But man, if you guys want to order a million, I'm in. You just got to let me know when and where. I'll drop ship them. You know what I mean?
Excellent. So what I was going to ask before, you're at 100% inspection. So anybody that's ordering, if I ordered 25 pieces of brass for $19.25 plus shipping, I'm guessing?
Yep. Yep. Yep.
Which is what, probably $4 or $5?
Yeah, six tops.
Something like that. You're getting,
those will be a 100% inspected brass.
Every single one's been looked at and inspected by somebody to say that this is good and passes. So
by a lady named Mel. Not just any old person, by a lady named Mel. She's awesome. We have a couple inspectors, and they're going through everything, and so it's inspected and made sure that it's gonna stand up what you want it to do.
Cool, and that's pretty. I think that's pretty cool for you know, for right now, for be able to, you know, you're getting something that is high quality, you know, because like you said, you're trying to make everything as high quality as possible. Well, and if it's getting 100% inspection on top of that, you know, I would have to guess that there's not much getting through.
Yeah, we haven't had anything get through yet. I hope to be able to say that forever. I don't think any manufacturer can say that forever, but
yeah. Well, for now, something will happen someday.
Yeah, we're going to do everything we can to make that day be long after I'm gone. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
after,
yeah.
Someone else.
Let somebody else deal with it?
Yeah, let's let my predecessor deal with that. I don't want to deal with that.
Yeah. Cool.
But yeah, we have about 40,000 pieces in inventory right now, I think.
Okay.
Excellent. So if someone wanted to order a bunch, we can handle quite a bit.
Awesome.
And we produce about 500,000 pieces a month. And so we can crank some brass.
Oh, that's cool. That's cool. And you know, the stuff that we've been talking about, the first draw, second draw, third draw, the trimming, the head stamping, the, you know, the cutting the extracting grooves, the tapers, the, you know, all that stuff. If you go to their website, which is www.petersoncartridge.com, you can go to How It's Made, and there's like detailed pictures of all of these processes, and you can actually kind of see how it's, you know, what it looks like during each step and kind of how it happens.
You know, I spent probably a month and a half, maybe more, designing that website, and it was designed around being informative. I wanted folks to be able to look at it and go, I get it. Not to just be, we're the best, we're the greatest, you got to love us. Why? Let's assign numbers and values to it. Why are we good? What processes do we do? So, I mean, that's above and beyond, you know, how it's made. That's the quality control page. You know, we have a quality assurance page that'll show you all the different steps that we do in quality assurance, and you know it lays it out. And so those, when I say our brass, I believe we make some of the best brass in the world, and I believe that because we've put in the checks in place, we put the inspections and the checks in place, and also machinery in place to be able to do it. It's not just marketing saying, yeah, we're the greatest, we're the best. Well, here's why. So, I mean, that was what the whole design around the website was not to be flashy, not to be super hard, just straightforward, basic. There's my picture. There's who I am, Derek Peterson. You know, here's my shop manager, Bob. He's Bob Snyde. He's fantastic. He's a great shop manager. Here's our accounting department. You know, so we that's how we build it. You know, here's our HR manager, just so it's very personable. You know, that picture of the building on there, that's our building. That's our factory. It doesn't look like a factory, but it is. and so it's on the contact us page. I think it's on the contact us page. And there's a big team photo of us where you can see all of us. There's not a ton of us, but we try really hard. So, you know, I hope that all your viewers can get the message that we're trying to send, which is we're a small personal group. If you've got a problem, call us If you have a problem with our product, something we sold you, call us. We want to know about it. We want to fix it. We want to make it right. So that's what it was all about.
Cool. Yeah, and at the Contact Us, there's a little form just like what we have on our website where you can punch your name and email and subject and message in. So that would be another easy way to request 6.5 Creedmoor Brass.
I'm going to have to put some more pressure on the higher-ups to get that 6.5. There's seriously been a big demand for it. I really hope we're able to do something. You know, people say it's just a neck-down 308, like a 260, you know.
Yeah, it's actually designed off the 30 TC.
Yeah, exactly. And so it's a little bit it's going to be, like, even what we found is even when it, if it was just, you know, I know it's not, but if it was just a neck-down 308, like the 260 is, it's trickier than just necking down a 308 to create a whole new caliber, even though it shares a common head size and a body size. The taper is different, and that affects in the draws, you know, when you're actually doing the draws, because if you try to just take a straight wall tube that was drawn for 308 and neck it down, you're going to have wall thickness problems. You're going to have a taper on your mouth wall that's going to be substantial. And it's going to cause some serious problems for you as a shooter. So there's a lot. I didn't realize how much goes into it, but, you know, until I got into it, but it's pretty complicated. So I'm going to tell you right now, I'm going to do my homework. I'm going to learn a whole bunch about the 6.5 Creedmoor. I'm going to try to become as knowledgeable as I can on it. And the next time we talk, I'm going to have hopefully a better answer for you than I hope we're able to make it. I'm going to work on.
Sounds good. Well, you got anything else you want to throw out there?
I'm thankful for you having me on, and I'm appreciative of all your listeners taking the time and listen to me, you know, jabber on and yammer on about something that I care about, I love, which is making brass. And I'm glad and I'm thankful for it. So that's it.
Yeah, no problem, man. And I think it was a pretty good show. So, we went over how brass is actually made. I don't know if many people really are familiar with that, which I know I wasn't before this. I'd like to thank the Firearms Radio Network for everything they do for us. You can find them at firearmsradio.tv. There are a lot of other great shows on the network, so go check them out. You can find us at precisionriflepodcast.com or at our Facebook page. Just search for Precision Rifle Podcast. Or you can get there from our website also. It'll bring you right to our Facebook. Get a hold of us there from our website or at precisionriflepodcast@gmail.com. With any questions or feedback or whatever. With that, everybody, take care. Try to get to the range, and we'll talk to you next week. Bye.
Thanks again.
All right, everybody. I just wanted to add this little section here right into the end, just to talk about a knife that I ordered, because we didn't do what we did this week, like I did want to get back into. But with that, everybody, here's Josh Wolf with J. Wolf Cutlery.
All right, everybody. I just ordered a. I know that this week I'm not going to do a. What I did this week in particular, because I did do it quite a bit. We're going to get into that next week. But I did order a pretty sweet knife and a straight razor from a company called J. Wolf Cutlery. And I actually have Josh with us today. I was pretty impressed with his stuff, and I wanted to have him on to kind of talk about what he's got going on. But Josh, you want to give a little background on yourself and the knife-making stuff?
Sure, yeah. Currently I'm in the Army still, the staff sergeant in the Army, and that's kind of where I grew up and with rifle marksmanship and knives and everything. But one day, as far as knife making is concerned, I kind of just decided to just do it one day, and I just kind of learned via YouTube and kind of one day seek someone out, which is Dan Peters, who's my mentor, and he's actually also still in the Army as well. And he was actually in the Army marksmanship unit. So I'm currently now in the the U.S. Army Sniper School as an instructor, and that's kind of where we went into as far as knife making is concerned for the Army for Association, and how we kind of decided to get that knife kind of contracted out to former and current snipers, and yeah, so.
Yeah, and that's the B4, correct? Because that would be the abbreviation, like if you were a 11 Bravo dash B4, right?
Well, what it is because anyone graduates the U.S. Army Sniper School, what they do is they get the another Army designation. So if you're in the infantry, you're an 11 Bravo. So once you graduate Sniper School, you get Bravo 4 or B4 attached onto your MOS. And so basically what we decided was is we were just going to call that knife the Bravo 4, because I initially designed it for the Army Sniper Association, and then I kind of decided that I was going to have a Bravo 4 knife for civilians and a Bravo 4 knife for sniper and former snipers who want to buy the knife through the association. So that's kind of why there's two knives. For the most part.
Yeah, and the one, you have to have been a current or former. Now, is it Army sniper or is it any sniper?
That's kind of up to the Army Sniper Association, actually. What they do is either someone comes to me or they come through the Army Sniper Association, and they have to verify that they were a sniper at some point. And I don't honestly know if you were a Marine Scout sniper or something like that, if you can buy one. I'm sure they're probably pretty lenient about it, because, I mean, a sniper is a sniper in our community. So
right.
I'm sure they'd be more than willing to do that. But basically, you have to just provide some type of proof that you were a sniper or you are a sniper. And once you provide that proof, they kind of take down all the numbers as far as serial numbers are concerned, or your membership number if you're part of the Army Sniper Association, and give all your information to me, and I make the knife and send it your way.
Cool. So. But you do sell knives other than the B4. But you want to talk about them just a little bit?
Yeah, I actually, my first production model that I ever came out with, and I actually came out with it in March, because that's when I started my company, what is called the Mako. And what it is, it's kind of a everyday carry skinner hunter knife almost. It's kind of a combination of all. You can use it every day, obviously, but it's more or less a hunter skinner. And it's about 4-inch blade, and it's about 7.25 to 7.5 inches in length. I mean, sometimes the design varies knife by knife, because I make them custom and I make them by hand. So if the customer wants like jimping on the spine, or wants the blade like a 1/4 inch longer or something like that, I'll try to change the design a little bit, but keep the basically the original design intact as much as I can. So that's kind of been my flagship knife. I made it, mainly called it the Mako, because I'm a big fan of Shark Week, and I thought it looked like a shark one day. I don't know why.
Nice, so. Nice.
That's one of the knives that I have. And then I also have the Bravo 4, which you know all about. And I make a couple of straight razors every now and again. It's always a custom straight razor, mainly because I don't really offer the production kind of thing, because most of the people that I buy knives for me are all hunters or military snipers who don't have any use for a straight razor, honestly. Straight razor is really a niche type of thing. So.
Right, right. Oh, for sure.
But, I have my brand new production model, which I just came out with actually last week, called the Viper, which was a co-design between myself and another former sniper who's also a member of the Army Sniper Association, Justin Vitito. And we designed it together, and it's mainly a tactical last-ditch survival knife. And that's primarily what it is. And that has a 5.5-inch blade, and that thing's a beast. That thing is – it's just light and near indestructible. He did all the testing on it. I actually have it on my page. And he cut that thing through a quarter. So that thing's it's pretty legit. I try to do my best to use very like high end steels, but keep the prices down, because I mean, I got into knife making because I kind of thought prices were a little high myself.
Mm-hmm.
Like, because if I want a crazy knife or something like that, and I see it's $400, I'm like, man, $400. I mean, now myself being a knife maker, I see why prices are that high. But I mean, I try to keep my prices within $100 or $300 range as best as I can. So
yeah, yeah. And my the B4 runs $200, correct?
Yeah, $200 on the civilian side. If you want the Army Sniper Association model, it's $250. And that's mainly because what you're also doing is you're contributing a portion of the funds to the Fallen Sniper Fund, which is ran by the Army Sniper Association. So a portion of the funds goes to that charity. So.
Oh, excellent. Well, that's, but, yeah, that's pretty
cool. And I also have some other things in mind. I'm actually thinking about doing a complete survival bushcraft line here pretty soon. So I actually posted the first design on my page about a couple of days ago. So.
Sure. And now you don't actually have a website. You kind of run everything off the Facebook page, and then you invoice through PayPal?
Yeah, that's primarily what I'm doing right now. Most of my sales have been through word of mouth or through Facebook. And I'm trying to get on all the Prepared Mind Facebook pages, and I'm starting to get my name out there in a lot of areas. But right now, it's all through the Facebook page or word of mouth or something like that. And I'm working on getting a website up. I'm hoping to have it up in January.
Cool.
So,
well, you'll have to let me know when it comes up. I really appreciate you taking some time to come on and talk about your knives. I'm really excited to get mine in. And I would like to set something up with you to have you come on and maybe talk about some of the fundamentals and stuff like that sometime.
Yeah, it sounds great. I'm excited to make both of those knives, as a matter of fact. So.
Yeah, I gave you a little bit of artistic freedom on those.
Oh, yeah. I mean, when you're making nothing but custom production models from time to time, and you're not really changing your design a lot, and a lot of people see just pictures of the last knife you made or something, they're like, oh man, that's a cool knife, I want that knife. And I'm like, okay, well, I just made that knife, but that's perfect.
Yeah.
So when you came to me and you're like, oh, I just want a nice knife, and you can do whatever you want, I just wanted to match, I'm like, sounds good to me. That's perfect.
So cool. Well, so, I'm really excited to get those in. I'm going to put a link up to your Facebook page in our show notes so the listeners can find you real easy. If you guys are looking for a good knife from a great guy, man, this is the guy to get them from.
I know what you're thinking. You're thinking, did he fire 6 shots or only 5? Now, to tell you the truth, I kind of forgot in all this excitement. But being this is the Guns of Hollywood podcast on the most popular pro-gun podcast network in the world and will blow your eardrums clean out, you've got to ask yourself a question. Have you subscribed yet? Well, have you, punk? GunsOfHollywood.com or search Guns of Hollywood on iTunes or your favorite podcatcher app. Punk.
This has been a production of the Firearms Radio Network. You can find more information at firearmsradio.tv.